And I'm going to be turning it over to our wonderful moderator, Rupa Patel, shortly. I just want to give a huge shout out and thank you to Rupa for partnering with the Choice Agenda on this webinar. We've been working on this for several months now, and Rupa has been just a fantastic partner and collaborator and a true innovator and task shifter, as you will find out. We have an amazing set of speakers from all over the world. Special shout out to Yani from the Ministry of Health in Malaysia, where it is very late in the day. So thank you, Yani, for staying up with us. Also, many thanks to our other great speakers, Megan, Juan Carlos, Carrie, who is dialing in from South Africa, where it's not so late, but it is getting towards the end of the day. And then Kevin in Houston. So we're going to be kind of going all around the world and back. And Rupa is going to be leading us through that. I'm going to stop sharing now. And I am going to turn the podium, as it were, over to my wonderful friend and colleague, Rupa Patel. Go ahead and take it away, Rupa.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you, everyone, for attending this webinar. We have five speakers from three countries. This is going to be fantastic. First, I'm going to give an introduction on why we're here today, what is task shifting, and what role does it play today. Then we'll hear from Yani Gan from University of Malay and part of the Ministry of Health there, who's done some innovative work in prep and pharmacies. And then we'll shift gears and look at Washington, D.C., where we'll have work from Whitman Walker Health, where they've implemented both treatment and prevention of long-acting injectables in unique settings and care by a unique delivery system. And then we'll go ahead and turn it over to South Africa. So Carrie Pike will speak, and she's a researcher from a Desmond Tutu Health Foundation. And then last but not least, we'll travel to Texas. Houston is the city where Kevin Elosis, who's the director of clinical and pharmacy operations, will speak about their program with pharmacists and long-acting at Legacy Health. I'm going to go ahead and transition over to some slides now on task shifting and slideshow from beginning. There we go. Jim, can you see the slides?
Yeah, look, yep, down there in speaker mode or
Excellent.
slideshow, they look fantastic. Thank you.
So we're going to transition into what the heck is task shifting? What is this definition that's been laid out? The reason we're talking about task shifting is we have to address the elephant in the room, which is the healthcare worker shortage, and that trend and the extrapolation of what that shortage is growing over time. And so we need additional 10 million health workers to cover a gap by 2030 to do basic primary care globally. And in general, you're starting to see a niche of a gap of 5.9 million workers, at least in the maternal and child healthcare realm, and that is nursing and midwives. So the WHO actually created a guideline in 2008 on task shifting and embraced it and wanted to integrate task shifting within parts of the health system in general. And they define task shifting in healthcare as a rational redistribution of tasks among health workforce teams. It allows for specific tasks to be moved where appropriate from highly qualified health workers to health workers with shorter training and fewer qualifications. And the approach has evolved over time. Over time, we actually saw in the 1960s, you had your iconic barefoot workers that evolved from China. Then South Asia created the same type of workers to essentially extend primary care to the rural areas. And then you have researchers that have created actual frameworks for how to do task shifting. The shift and share framework comes from Europe, and really the implementation science of developing task shifting programs. And you have other researchers also around the world that basically give you the nuts and bolts for the elements of successful task shifting. For the scope of this presentation, I'm not going to go into the details. I wanted to give you an overview, but there's a lot of literature here. In terms of models, We started in the 1960s and we started developing evidence that is growing since the 1980s. Some of those models include, the opioid addiction and the epidemic and task shifting there in terms of administration of naloxone. We have in HIV itself, we had task shifting demonstrated by Partners in Health and other agencies around the nation, the globe. And then in South Asia, you saw a very particular task shifting in family planning and skilled birth attendance to bring down maternal mortality. And some of the literature, I'm just choosing a focus of one country to dive into some of the high impact literature, randomized control trials that came out. And this is just to give you an aspect. In the 1970s in The Lancet, it was published that to carry out tubectomies at that time. And so what ended up happening is you eventually had in the rural area when the paraprofessionals were actually compared to the infectious diseases doctors, you had the same infection rate and surgery outcomes. This also transitioned to the day-to-day neonatal health when newborns in rural Bangladesh would actually have blood infections. A cadre of community health workers actually injected antibiotics in newborns in order to treat infection. And then in another last article is that we had infectious diseases epidemiologic control, where community health workers actually helped identify by symptoms and administer TB medications and follow individuals from 6 to 9 months to drive down rates of TB. So this is all robust literature to say with very complex tasks, we have shown equivalent outcomes to medical providers in certain scenarios. Lastly, there is in Washington State Health Department. In the state of Washington, there was actually some of the first of its kind legislation that allows disease intervention specialists who are trained in disease contact tracing, and they received extra training in terms of giving syphilis injections. And when you think of task shifting, you just want to think about your policy at the organization and national level, your certification, your scope of work, and how your clients will perceive receiving care from someone other than a medical doctor. And as you are sitting here to develop policy, please think about the who, what, where, and what type of oversight. Could this be a mobile clinic where a nurse delivers care or a community health worker that's trained in injections delivers care? And who will do that oversight? Is it by tele-supervision or is it by a doctor? Is it by a nurse? Is it on-site, off-site? So you're going to think about all these elements as you design programs. So in summary, when we have our next speakers take it away, we have robust evidence. It's feasible in terms of task shifting for multiple items, and we should make long-term policies now to go ahead and lay down the framework for task shifting. So I'm going to go ahead and invite Yanni to share her slides.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to share my slides right now. Okay, can everyone see my slides? Okay, can everyone hear me clearly?
Yep, we can
We
hear
can
you,
hear
Yanni,
you?
and your slides look
Okay.
great. Thank you.
Okay, great. First of all, hi everyone. My name is Yeni. I'm from Malaysia. Good evening. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share about our experience in setting up the pilot program for pharmacy-led oral PrEP service delivery model in Malaysia. As Rupa introduced, I'm from the Ministry of Health Malaysia, and I'm also working on my PhD in UC Malaya. Just to begin, let's start with a snapshot of HIV landscape in Malaysia. We have about over 3,000 new HIV diagnoses in 2023. More than 90% were via sexual transmission, and almost half of the new HIV diagnoses were among individuals aged 20 to 29 years old. And almost half of these new HIV diagnoses are in urban Klang Valley. And this includes the Kuala Lumpur, which is the capital of Malaysia. So among the key populations, the prevalence is highest among MSM. So at the time of this project, we had only oral PrEP. But just to share right now, we already have the long-acting injectable PrEP approved and is now available in Malaysia. But focusing on oral PrEP, which was available at the time of project, it has been available in Malaysia via private clinics on a self-pay basis, but it has also been offered for free in selected public health clinics since 2023. Despite its proven benefits, the number of there were only 4,421 users accessing the free public program in last year. And I just wanted to highlight that we have an estimate of key population members of about 354,000, many of whom might have been benefit from this PrEP program. So we realized that there is lack of PrEP access. There's a need for an additional service remodel outside of medical facilities in the private sector, which could provide this stigmatizing care. So when I started the project, I was wondering why have you not leveraged the community pharmacists in HIV prevention? They are trained healthcare professionals and well suited to provide PrEP service through effective task shifting. Just to share, I'm also a pharmacist myself, so I was thinking, why not? I mean, pharmacies are widely accessible. We have more than 3,000 pharmacies in Malaysia with extended operating hours. Adults frequently visit the pharmacies, and also pharmacies are often the first point of contact for health advice. So it presented a great opportunity to explore this model to expand PrEP access. And this led to our pilot implementation study. And this is the first example of real-world PrEP care in pharmacies in this country. And it also provided a chance to expand the scope of care for pharmacists. And we believe that the methods and tools we use to plan out the project can help other health programs. And so for this pilot program, our approach is through the implementation science perspective, where we design the approach based on the EPIS framework. Our objective is to implement the pharmacy-led PrEP service at six selected private pharmacies in Klang Valley. And to know whether the program works, we look into six implementation outcomes, and these include acceptability, appropriateness, feasibility, fidelity, and sustainability. And for these outcomes, the data were collected through a post-study online survey. And then for the adoption uptake, we assess this based on the PrEP user records. So prior to implementation, we carry out pre-implementation work. We started with the first phase, exploration phase. We conducted semi-structured in-depth interviews to identify what are the perceived barriers and facilitators to the pharmacy-led PrEP service among three groups of people: key population members, PrEP prescribers, and community pharmacists. And then we move on to the second phase, which is to prepare for implementation. We started off with stakeholder consultation to refine the implementation plan based on the qualitative findings from the phase one. And then we move on to online self-paced training, followed by in-person training and also dry run at each pharmacy to help the pharmacists get ready through practice in a real-world setting. And so for the pilot project, we conducted a 12-month multi-site single-arm prospective study at these six private pharmacies in Klang Valley. The potential PrEP users in the pilot project that we included were Malaysians aged 18 to 49 who are interested to use PrEP based in Klang Valley, understand English or Malay, and willing to pay for PrEP and lab tests as advice. We included only low-risk individuals, and we did not include individuals with risk of kidney impairment, people who are age 50 and above with kidney-related comorbidities and extra. So we targeted a sample size of 450 and we recruited people using convenient sampling. The recruitment methods include social media platform. We also created an Instagram account called My PrEP Pharmacy to help people to get to know about the pilot program. And then we also recruited through the help of NGOs, community outreach, as well as on-site identification. So We also form so we formulated the prep pharmacy model, which looks like this. We wanted to simplify it as much as we can, not only for the prep users but also for the pharmacists. So the prep users start with booking an appointment online through the preferred with their preferred pharmacy. Once they arrive at the pharmacy, so everything happens at the pharmacy, and the pharmacists assess the prep eligibility using a digital checklist-based assessment tool. They also assist in HIV testing at the pharmacy using an oral fluid HIV self-test kit, and then followed by prep counseling. If the person's eligible and they're willing to start or continue prep, the pharmacist then get a prescription from a physician via telemedicine. So this helps to enable same-day prep. And in this model, the pharmacists collaborate with NGOs, physicians, clinic providers for lab testing needs and referrals. And then the prep users are followed at the pharmacy. And so everything happens at the pharmacy. We try to make sure as everything happens under on average 30 to 60 minutes. So this is a real-world implementation where it involves out-of-pocket expenses. We want to find out whether this will be sustainable in a private pharmacy setting. So in this model, people pay for PrEP, medication, as well as lab tests as advised. And so to assess the implementation outcomes for the acceptability, appropriateness, and feasibility, we use validated metrics. And then for sustainability, we measure based on overall satisfaction level, as well as willingness to recommend or continue using the service at retail prices. For the fidelity, which means basically we want to find out whether the pharmacists follow the clinical protocol, we assess based on six key aspects, which are privacy, HIV screening, counseling, kidney function monitoring, dispensing and follow-up tasks, as well as quality of care, specifically whether the pharmacists were respectful and non-judgmental. So let's look at the results. About 98% of those who approach started PrEP. And then they scored the acceptability, appropriateness, and feasibility about between 4.76 to 4.81 out of 5. And then in terms of the follow-up, in the first follow-up, the retention rate was 82%, followed by 75% in the second follow-up, and then the 72% in the third follow-up. And as for fidelity, how well did pharmacists follow the protocol? They did very well, in fact. The PrEP users rated everything above 4.5 out of 5, and the highest rating was for respectful interaction. So in terms of sustainability, the PrEP users rated overall satisfaction of 9.39 out of 10, and then the willingness to recommend the service to others were 98%, and 82% were willing to continue using the service at retail price, citing reasons such as accessibility, convenience, affordability, and privacy. And then 70% were not willing to continue using a service, citing reasons such as cost, stopping PrEP due to sexual inactivity, as well as location. So just want to share what are the lessons learned from building the program. It was certainly challenging at first to get the stakeholder buy-in. We definitely need to engage consistently and with our various stakeholders. And while there were a lot of stakeholders who were supportive of the pilot program, there were also a few pushbacks from certain stakeholders. And so the question that stakeholders mostly asked was, is this going to work? And the only way to find out is to create a pilot program to demonstrate potential success. We wanted to And from the pilot program, then only we have data to show whether it is feasible or scalable. And we also learned that it's really important to have the clinical support to help the pharmacies. This is quite a new model for them. So we ensured that physicians are available for clinical advice, especially during extended pharmacy hours, because a lot of PrEP users, they prefer to come after office hours and as well as weekends, understandably. And there was high turnover among community pharmacists, and this is quite common in the private community pharmacy setting. So a robust, accessible training program needs to be created for new staff. The training needs to be both online and hands-on to make sure that the new pharmacist was able to provide the PrEP service in a competent way. And we also learned that the scope of training must go beyond PrEP. So the PrEP training for the training for pharmacists primarily focus on PrEP, but we also learned that the pharmacists need to be trained just as much on post-exposure prophylaxis, hepatitis B and C, and other STIs. I just want to acknowledge that all parties who contribute to this research, this project, my supervisors, the project team, all pharmacies, all individuals who are willing to try this model of prep care, as well as the support of the Malaysian Pharmacy Society and various collaborators, and of course our funders. It really took a village to make this happen. Thank you, everyone. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Yanni. And now we welcome the slides to be shared for the Whitman Walker Health team, Megan Dietrich, Physician Assistant, Whitman Walker Health, and Juan Carlos Lubre, who is the Manager in Community Health Department at Whitman Walker Health.
Great. Thank you, Rupa, and thank you, Megan and Juan Carlos. I am going to go ahead and share your slides. Let me just get this organized here. Are they looking okay?
They look great.
All right. Go ahead and take it away, Megan.
So my name is Megan Dietrich, and I'm a physician assistant and a research clinician at Whitman Walker Health in Washington, D.C. Today, I'll be discussing how our health center has embraced task shifting to enhance the implementation of long-acting injected medications for the treatment of HIV. And a little later, Juan Carlos will be discussing this topic for HIV prevention. First, I'd like to give you a little background on Whitman Walker Health for context. Next slide, please. Established in 1978 and named for poet Walt Whitman and the female Civil War era physician Mary Walker, Whitman Walker Health is an FQHC and a patient-centered medical home with a specialization in LGBTQ and HIV care. We strive to empower all persons to live healthy, love openly, achieve equality and inclusion, and have been recognized as a Healthcare Equity Index leader since 2011 and a national quality leader since 2013. In 2013, we provided primary care to over 12,000 individuals and approximately 3,800 individuals living with HIV. We prescribe over 4,200 patients PrEP, and we serve a distinctly diverse population representative of our community that we aim to serve. Notably, 38% of our population identify as lesbian and gay, 16% of our population are trans, 38% are African American, and 58% of our clients are below the age of 40, which makes us an ideal site to provide HIV prevention and treatment. The estimated prevalence of HIV in Washington, D.C. is 1.8%, with just under 12,000 individuals living with HIV. Whitman Walker treats approximately a quarter of these individuals with an overall viral suppression rate of 84%, which exceeds the city estimated rate of 66%. In terms of incidence, of the 230 newly diagnosed cases, 38% of these new infections were diagnosed through our HIV and STI testing services. Next slide, please. We offer a wide variety of services, including medical, dental, pharmacy, behavioral health, legal, research, across three sites and a mobile van in both Northwest and Southeast DC. Today, we'll focus on our HIV specialty care, home visit program through more, and our PrEP clinic. While these programs are vital, our true strength is the integration of all of our services working together to provide holistic patient-centered care. Next slide, please. With the exciting approval of long-acting injectable cabotegravir/rilpivirine in 2021, we quickly began to think of how to most efficiently integrate this new treatment into our clinical practice. Not only because we are a site for the ATLAS trials and had patients interested in continuing off trial, but also because we recognized that long-acting injected treatment had the potential to drastically change the landscape of HIV as we know it. Whitman Walker's implementation of this treatment all started with a working group in late 2021 to develop a prescribing protocol for providers and a workflow to ensure we could most efficiently navigate insurance challenges, coding and billing, as well as patient and medication tracking. One of the most valuable additions to this team was the hiring of a pharmacy tech who handles all of the long-acting injectable prescriptions. And we also shifted the task of our existing care navigators from focusing on patient retention and engagement to scheduling and tracking of injection windows. Additionally, our medical assistants and medical providers were both trained in the administration of injections, and our population health and quality department created a recurring report in Relevant, which is a real-time population health platform to track patients and injection windows. After careful planning, we developed a standardized workflow to ensure that every prescription of long-acting injected cabrilpivirine follows the same consistent pathway, with the goal of building an efficient system that we could scale up quickly to meet the demands of our patients. Next slide, please. The first step in our workflow, oops, there. The first step in our workflow is for providers to send a prescription to the specialized pharmacy tech to check for coverage in a telephone encounter, which is a message in the EMR that we can prescribe from. Once coverage is obtained, the same TE is assigned to a care navigator to schedule the patient for their first injection. And once the date and time is set, the TE is then forwarded to the nurse manager, who adds the patient to the list in Relevant, where the injection window will be tracked. The nurse manager distributes lists weekly to the MAs and to the pharmacies, so the MAs can pick the injections up for the week and store them on the refrigerators of each of the medical floors. This way, the injections are available for the visits for the week. In contrast to the long-acting PrEP injections, which JC will discuss a little bit later, the long-acting cabrilpivirine injections are given by MAs during the medical visit. And at the end of this visit, the care navigator schedules the next visit so patients don't have to rely on the front desk. Once the care navigator schedules this next injection, they send a TE to the nurse manager with the injection date, and that starts this cycle, which is noted in orange again and again and again, and it just keeps cycling. We also have a Teams chat to help troubleshoot any issues that come up in real time. It's not a perfect system, but it's getting more and more efficient. And we now have over 380 patients on long-acting injectable cabrilpivirine, with many of whom have been on for over 2 years. And we have a viral suppression rate of 97% with about 86% persistence. Of the 3% who are not suppressed, most have a viral load just over 200 who have not yet had their viral load drawn after starting. We have no confirmed virologic failures at this time. Next slide, please. Now I'd like to walk you through our task shipping approach to scale up our long-acting treatment program. First, we shifted the responsibility of administering injections from providers to medical assistants. This integration into regular clinic flow, just like our STI treatments and vaccinations, eliminated the need for a separate injection clinic and saves resources. It also increased provider touch points and freed up time during visits to address other primary care needs. Next, we streamlined the insurance and prior authorization process by assigning it to the specialized pharmacy technician. This shift reduced the burden on our medical admin assistants, who already have an overwhelming amount of prior authorizations for other medications, and this also allowed the technician to build an expertise in LAI coverage. With all prescriptions going through this specialized role, we've reduced delays and improved efficiency. Finally, we reassigned scheduling and follow-up for patients on LAI to our care navigators. This removed the burden from our front desk and call center, allowing them to focus on other patient needs and promoting consistency in the scheduling and window tracking. Each care navigator manages a defined patient panel, ensuring timely appointments and enabling the system to scale smoothly. As patient volume increases, we can add a care navigator or transition reliable patients back to regular scheduling. Additionally, patients form tight connections with their care navigators, and these personalized connections foster better communication, adherence, and persistence with treatment. Together, these task shifts have created a streamlined, scalable system, allowing us to serve over 380 patients with room to grow. Next slide, please. Despite early successes with long-acting injected cabrilpivirine, providers were initially hesitant to prescribe for people living with HIV facing adherence challenges due to the initial FDA guidance. Ironically, this is the group that serves to most likely benefit from these medications. So to bridge this gap, we leveraged our existing mobile outreach retention and engagement program, or the MOR program, to support these patients and increase provider confidence in prescribing to this population. Moore was designed in 2015 by our chief of programs and initially funded by a public-private partnership between DC Department of Health, Washington AIDS Partnership, Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation, and MacAIDS Fund to address the needs of people living with HIV with adherence challenges. It has now become fully integrated into our standard of care at Whitman Walker, and it's mainly supported through Wainwright funding. To qualify, you must be a person living with HIV with an unsuppressed viral load or have been out of care for over 6 months. Moore provides a spectrum of services aimed at overcoming barriers to care and adherence. This range can be as simple as appointment reminders, scheduling, rides through a rideshare, or it can be as high touch as having medical visits, lab draws, and care navigation within patient homes. The Moore team consists of a mobile medical provider, which is me, which is either a PA or an NP with AAHIVS certification and direct supervision by an ID physician. Two mobile care navigators to perform intake interviews, schedule and coordinate care for patients, as well as help with adherence counseling, and a manager with a social work background who facilitates weekly care planning meetings. Typical caseloads for the mobile care navigators are ideally around 50 patients each. And the medical provider provides the medical care, but the care navigators are really the heart of the Moore team, and often our patients refer to them as their person. Next slide, please. Visits. We travel in pairs of a provider and a mobile care navigator, and we take a medical bag, which has blood pressure cuff, scale, and all like phlebotomy supplies. Typically, we drive together to the patient house, and the care navigator confirms the visit the day before and a half hour prior to leaving for the visit, as most places in DC take us about 20 minutes to drive to. We call and text once we arrive at the patient location so that we can be let in. And during the visit, we conduct routine medical follow-up activities, including vital signs, limited pee, and draw blood if indicated. We do not perform sensitive exams in the home, but we can bring STIs for self-collection. Labs are returned to the closest clinic to be processed and sent out by our existing LabCorp phlebotomist. So the turnaround time for the labs is identical to those drawn on site. Next slide, please. When thinking about how to integrate long-acting injections into the Moore home visits, it was important for us to fit seamlessly into the original workflow on site to avoid confusion. We managed to do this with two small differences, which are noted in red. Number one, the pharmacy tech sends the T to the mobile care navigator rather than regular care navigator, who schedules the patient. And number two, when it comes time for the injections to be given during a home visit, the mobile medical provider, which is me, picks up the medication from the medical floor fridge and puts it in an insulin cooler where we keep the temperature between 35 and 45 degrees Fahrenheit while we drive to the patient's house. And we do have a car charger for that cooler. Once we arrive at the patient house, we confirm that we're going to do the injection at that visit. And only at that point do we take the medication out of the cooler and allow it 15 minutes to warm up to room temperature. During that 15 minutes, we do the vital signs, HPI, PE if needed, we draw labs. And then once the 15 minutes is up, we ask the patient to lie in a bed or a couch. One patient has a chaise lounge. We kind of make it work within the home. We give the injections and then we dispose of the syringes and needles in a sharps container. And then we finish up the visit in the 10-minute observation after the injection. To date, we have completed over 50 home injections. To give you a sense of who the patients are, the first patient to have a home visit was a mid-50s woman with a special needs daughter who has been with a Moore program since the very beginning. Given her competing priorities, she has struggled to take daily ARVs and did have a small viral load prior to initiating long-acting cabrilpivirine. At her first home injection, she asked her daughter to come and hold her hand while we did her injections, and it was a really touching moment to kind of kick off our home visits. The labs that we drew that day in her apartment revealed that she was undetected, and she was thrilled. I have many anecdotal stories about the power of home visits and could talk for hours about the benefits, but one of our goals with this project is to also gather concrete data. Next slide, please. In March, we were able to present early outcomes for our program at CROI on our first 44 patients. We now have over 60 patients in the program. The median age of this group was 44 years, 39% were cis female, 11% trans female, 93% African American, and 82% were publicly insured. A comparison group from our clinic population was matched for age, gender, and race. And in the MORE group, 27% had baseline viremia, and at 4 months, 100% of these 42 patients were undetected. Adherence or on-time injections within 7 days was 88%, and 92% remained on the LAAI treatment. Next slide, please. In contrast to the task shifting we used to scale up in clinic delivery, the focus of the task shifting in the MORE program was to scale down to provide personalized, streamlined care for patients living with HIV facing adherence challenges. Our goal is to simplify treatment for patients who often feel overwhelmed by barriers like transportation, health literacy, and competing priorities. Since we can't bring the full clinic team to the home visit, multiple tasks are shifted to the MORE team. The mobile provider takes on medical assistant tasks such as taking vital signs and drawing blood, doing the injection, but also provides medical care and serves as a proxy for an infectious disease specialist who's always available by phone. The mobile care navigator takes on scheduling, transportation coordination, appointment reminders, and also serves as a liaison to services such as public benefits, behavioral health, and pharmacies as needs arise. Care navigators help patients avoid the frustration of navigating complex phone systems or overcoming barriers in the pharmacy. This high-touch, targeted approach allows for us to meet patients where they are, literally and figuratively, and when appropriate, transition them back to routine clinic care once they are stable and ready. Next slide, please. Whether we're shifting tasks to scale up in-clinic delivery or to personalize care through programs like MORE, our approach to long-acting injectable treatment and prevention reflects a broader commitment to the status-neutral continuum. And there's an animation here if you want to click one more time. By focusing on individuals' needs regardless of HIV status, we center our efforts on access, engagement, and equity. This task shifting has not only enabled us to expand our reach efficiently, but also provide more tailored, human-centered care. It's this flexibility and responsiveness that allows us to meet people where they are and ensure no one is left behind on the continuum of care. And with that, I'll shift to the other side of this continuum and turn the floor over to Juan Carlos Lobreal, our Senior Director of Community Health, who will share task shifting strategies for the implementation of long-acting injectables for HIV prevention. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Good morning or good evening. Thank you for the invitation to come and share our work and experiences on task shifting. Next slide, please. So now I would like to discuss our implementation efforts. As Megan mentioned, we were guided by the status neutral continuum, and we needed to look at how we implemented an injectable care continuum. So to scale up in a high volume clinic, we needed to create novel ways to deliver care and apply task shifting. So Widnall Walker from the get-go created the long-acting injectable care continuum for both prevention and treatment. You already heard about the treatment side. And on the prevention side, we decided to integrate the delivery of injectable PrEP into the PrEP clinic and have our PrEP specialists administer it. They deliver care with great competency and high quality through our quality assurance programs. Next slide, please. So to increase PrEP uptake significantly in 2018, our community health department created a five-person team of PrEP specialists to operate the PrEP clinic. And as background, I would like to provide a quick overview of our PrEP clinic program. So, how does this program work? So, clients see a medical provider before being started on PrEP. Then they are transitioned to the PrEP clinic where clients fall under the care of PrEP specialists. A PrEP specialist is a non-licensed community health worker who receives training on the CDC guidelines for PrEP care, rapid HIV testing and counseling, harm reduction, phlebotomy, and medication pickup. They also optimize medication adherence, assist with retention, and have novel ways of using SMS messages to reach clients. There is a quarterly order prep clinic visit that is an expedited 20-minute appointment. So our clinic is one-stop shop for prep follow-up care. And if the patient is utilizing our pharmacy, we will hand them the medication at the appointment. And the specialists are able to provide same-day or next-day referral linkage within Whitmer Walker Health to acute care, mental health, primary care, and other services. Next slide, please. We have been evaluating this clinic since the inception of the program, and we presented our findings at IPAC in 2023. That we have updated the data since then, and we continue to show higher oral prep retention compared to the medical clinic. If we look quickly at this graph, it shows that first, there is consistently high retention, above 70%, and in some cases, over 90% in the prep clinic. And secondly, the prep clinic had consistently higher retention when compared to our medical clinic. Next slide, please. So now we are going to look at our implementation process, and we used the implementation science framework with five domains. And the first one that I would like to highlight is the outer setting. And when we looked at the outer setting, it was critical for us to look at the health law and what our health law allows us to do in the district in terms of non-licensed professionals. So if you are a non-licensed provider, we saw that we could have on-site intramuscular injections under the supervision of a provider. In another jurisdictions, MAs, nursing staff can be professionals who can conduct the injections. So the prep specialist is part of our healthcare team based on our interpretation of the FDA and the DC health policies. In terms of the inner settings at the organizational level, we looked at how comfortable our prep specialists were with injections. So this is a ventral-gluteal injection. So we explore how to get folks more comfortable injecting a landmark where we're not used to identify and injecting. Additionally, I want to go through the list of things that we did to share some lessons learned. We gather insights from everyone from HPTN and people throughout the United States. We went through a legal review that was very extensive. The implementation period was 1 year for us. We develop protocols and workflow. In the next slide, I will go into the extensive program and training we set up. We assigned and trained our prep navigators to manage the injectable schedule. Our pharmacy hired a long-active injectable coordinator for both treatment and prevention who handles insurance eligibility. Could we advance the slide one more time, please? Thank you. And managing medical inventory is critical. So we created a dashboard with a detailed flow of inventory. So that database provides us in real time how many injections we are given and how many missed appointments we are experiencing. And billing is a big issue too. If the client's insurance coverage is a medical benefit, we needed to buy the medication before we administer it. And then we got the money back. So our clinic lost at least tens of thousands of dollars in the process to start up because we were not getting reimbursed immediately. Next slide, please. So now briefly, I'm going to talk about our training program. This training was developed by our prep clinic medical lead and included a combination of lectures and hands-on sessions. So we started with two didactic lectures covering guidelines and messaging, followed by two 90-minute mock sessions focused on landmark identification. The training was split into parts: how to use the vial and drop off the medication, then how to locate the correct landmark for injections. We included in-clinic observation, where a specialist shadowed providers for several hours a day to understand the full patient interaction from preparing the injection to administer it. We recorded feedback sessions, logged each specialist's monthly injections, and held both group and one-on-one reviews. And the logs also tracked experience with clients across different BMIs. We also held two group feedback sessions where peers observe each other and give input. And the peer teaching cover injectable prep workflow, documentation, and technique. There was a 45-minute written exam session on the procedure checklist and regular service every 2 to 4 weeks to assess confidence and tailor future teaching. And we also hosted weekly 30-minute case reviews. And as you see in the picture, we designed a theme room, spa theme room with music to help clients feel relaxed and safe during injections. Next slide, please. We presented our CAP Community Health Board program model at CROIN 2024, where we focus on our hands-on training. Next slide, please. We also presented our 9-month injectable breath retention outcomes at IPAC in 2024. And as background, our primary outcome was a 9-month retention defined as an injection received plus and minus 7 days. And we also had a secondary outcome, which was an injection at 9 months plus and minus 14 days. And what you see here is a graphical vision of 9-month retention outcomes by population. And this highlights the difference between 7 days and 14 days. And we first look at the 7 days, which is our primary outcome. It was technically low, 68, 68, 70, 54, 64, but that is technically US national average. But within 7 days, we saw that people came. So it goes up drastically when you increase it by 7 day. So meaning that people missed the first appointment and our community health workers contacted them and they came. And the retention plus and minus 14 days carried through all populations. Next slide, please. We had a survey. This is very important. We did a survey every month where we asked clients about their experience and satisfaction with the process and administration. And overall, we had a great satisfaction. Next slide, please. So, our lessons learned. I will walk you through how our organization embraced task shifting, specifically training non-licensed staff to administer injectable prep. So, it started with a bold question: could we safely expand access by shifting tasks away from licensed provider? Early conversations center around access, equity, and staff capacity. We knew legal considerations were crucial, so we reviewed local scope of practice laws and consulted healthcare attorneys to ensure we stayed compliant. We also engaged our staff unions early. Transparency about the roles, training, and protections helped us build trust. From the client side, we were upfront. So clients were informed that trained supervised staff, non-licensed provider, would be administering the injections, and they responded with openness, especially when framed around faster and more consistent access. And providers took more convincing. So we addressed liability concerns, provided evidence of safety, and emphasized strong supervision structures. Every injector was closely supervised by licensed clinicians, and protocols were strictly followed. And of course, we hit roadblocks. We lost some revenue in billing claims in the early stages. Our medical leadership had to make clear top-down decisions supporting this shift. And organizational is required buy-in in every level. The good news is that over time, our community health workers got comfortable with the robust training, shadowing, and supportive feedback loops. And in the end, so what is the biggest lessons? Task shifting is not just possible. It is essential for scaling prep access, but it demands legal due diligence, cultural change, and dedicated leadership. Next slide, please. These are our acknowledgments, and this is the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Excellent. And we invite Carrie Pike now from the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation to load her slides. And she's the PI of the Prepare to Choose project and a researcher there.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you, Rupa. Can you see my slides?
Yes.
Great. Great. My name is Carrie Pike. I'm from the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation, which is in Cape Town, South Africa. And I am going to be sharing with you how we are trying to be innovative in expanding PrEP access in our setting. So at the foundation, differentiated service delivery is one of our core principles that we use to approach implementation science. We're always thinking about the when, the where, the who, and the what. When it comes to PrEP, with the when, we're not just thinking about longer acting modalities, but we're also thinking about how can we get longer PrEP refills out for people. For the who, a lot of our programs are already nurse-led, but we're always trying to see where we can use task shifting to bring in the rest of our team, which is quite large and includes HIV counselors, peer navigators, pharmacists, and many other people. When we're thinking about the where, we work in some primary healthcare clinics, but we also are really focused on getting out of the clinic, getting into mobile clinics, getting into schools and community areas, into pharmacies. And we also are trialing a courier service, which I'll explain a bit later. And then in terms of the what, we are expanding the PrEP options that are available in our setting. But we are also always trying to integrate our PrEP services with sexual reproductive health services like family planning and STI testing and a few other things. So one of the big platforms that we use to trial all our ideas is called the Fast PrEP platform. It's a Bridge to Scale program funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it really is adolescent and young people focused, which is one of our primary populations that we would like to prevent HIV in. And we work across a single health district, which is fairly large. And within this health district, we are trialing a range of different delivery services that people can use to access their PrEP. So, as I said, we work within the primary healthcare settings and we're integrated into those clinics, but we also have four mobile clinics that are adolescent themed. We have community depots, we work within the high schools, and we have that courier service. When this program started, only oral PrEP was available in South Africa. But as time has gone on, we've managed to layer in different PrEP modalities. So first we had the Dapi Ring become available and we added it to all of these services so that you could access it from any of these sites. But then once injectable CAB became available, we built a much smaller study from just two of these sites, from a clinic and from a mobile, called Prepared to Choose. And this is where we offered all three modalities to really see how it would be taken up in our setting and how we could be innovative in delivering this in a more real-world setting compared to a clinical trial. So because we are implementation studies, we are always thinking about how can we enhance PrEP adoption, by which we mean how can we support people in their choice, how we can we support the provider and their knowledge, and also support the community and getting the information out there. We think about clinic flows a lot. What does a clinic flow look like in a clinic versus a mobile versus a community area? And how can we bring in the injectable now, as well as the ring, to see how we can minimize disruption to that clinical flow? We also, of course, are interested in PrEP persistence and how can we support people in staying on PrEP for as long as possible and as long as is appropriate for them. So when we're doing this, we like to say that we're trying to keep it real world. And we're always asking our teams and asking ourselves whether the innovations that we're coming up with and the strategies that we're trialing are really suitable for our setting, which by nature is a low resource setting. We try to keep things quite low tech. And we try and make sure that anything that we build within this implementation platform, we can hand off to other people to scale up and make sure it's still suitable and sustainable. So with all that in mind, when we bought in an injectable cabotegravir, what we really wanted to do is see what people would do with it. So we've allowed all our participants in our projects to have free choice. There's no randomization element. They receive choice counseling, which is quite structured and was co-designed by the PrEP users and the PrEP providers themselves. And then they're allowed to choose their product and they're also allowed to switch. So they're allowed to start on injectable cab, move to oral, move to the ring, and go back. And we've seen some wild journeys and we've seen some very sustainable journeys as we've allowed people to do that. And we've tracked those patterns. In the South African public system, everything is, including PrEP, is offered free of charge. So we are not charging for these services, but we're also not offering any reimbursement, which is a big difference from clinical trials that previously offered injectable PrEP in South Africa. And we, as much as we want people to be able to move and switch between products, we also wanted them to be able to move and switch between delivery sites. So somebody who maybe started on PrEP at the mobile, but now wants to go to their local clinic, we wanted to allow that and also track it. So we have an online biometric system so people can put their fingerprint down and dial into the whatever delivery site they show up to, and we can see where they come up and the frequency by which they're accessing the different delivery sites. One consideration within our public sector is that there's likely very little ability to follow people up with sustained or very heavy retention efforts. What we typically do is we have clinic appointment cards. So we use that, we issue that to all our participants so that they know when their next appointment is. And we also give them an SMS 1 week prior. But besides from that, we do very minimal retention and we try and see what people do when they left to it by themselves so that we can really model what this would look like in the real world. So this is the community that we work within. It's a very large, very high density area with more than a million people. It's generally quite a low socioeconomic setting. And for injectable cabotegravir, we work from the two sites. So the primary healthcare clinic is embedded within this community and it's nurse led. It has an HIV counselor and a peer navigator and a pharmacist or a pharmacy assistant, but there are no doctors on site. They can be dialed in, but there's no one at the clinic itself. And the context is that PrEP services are delivered within family planning services. So they are integrated into a very busy clinic that is offering a lot of other things at the same time. Our mobile looks slightly different. You can see a picture over here. Our mobiles rotate across a fixed schedule throughout this area. They go to very busy places where we expect to find adolescents and young people, like transport hubs and shopping malls. And they have the benefit of having extended hours. So they operate a little bit further into the afternoon, which makes it ideal for people who are coming from work or coming from school, while the clinics tend to close a little bit earlier. So, as I said, these programs are nurse-led, and that's because PrEP can be prescribed and administered by nurses who have a certain certificate that allows them to do that, called NEMAT. Within South Africa, there has been a push to allow pharmacists to provide PrEP as well, but this is currently still going through our court system with a bit of backlash from medical doctors. But definitely the nurses are the leaders for this program. And what we've really tried to do in terms of task shifting is see how much we can take away from the nurses that and give to other people to minimize the time that the person has to spend with the nurse and really make this an efficient service because there is only one nurse on the mobile and they see quite high volumes of participants in a day. So we have peer navigators. So these are young people from the area. They do our health promotion and they tell people about PrEP. But I think something that's quite important is they do a lot of the logistical and administrative navigation with the participant. They really help them figure out what the process is going to be, where they need to go, what they need to do before they even get into the clinic flow. And especially within our clinics, that can really save someone, especially an adolescent who isn't maybe very familiar with that. It can save them a lot of time. Then we get to our HIV counselor who does so much of this work. They do the HIV testing, the pre and post-test counseling, which is standard. But they also do so much more than that. They do a range of other screenings, including STI screening, mental health care screening. We screen for tuberculosis in our setting as well. And then they do all of our PrEP choice counseling training. So as I said earlier, our PrEP choice counseling is incredibly structured. It takes about 30 minutes. And something that is constantly fed back to us by our youth reference group, which is a group of young people that advise on all our implementation projects, is that no matter how long that they have spent in a queue waiting to be seen by the healthcare provider, they really appreciate the one-on-one time that they have with the counselor or with the nurse. And that's very important for them that they have that time to unpack, to ask questions, to contextualize why they are accessing PrEP or any healthcare service. So doing this with the counselor really saves the nurse a lot of time and allows the nurse to really focus on screening for clinical eligibility criteria for administering PrEP and then also doing our blood draws, as which is related to the PrEP initiation. But on our mobiles and at the clinic, we also do STI point of care testing with a gene expert. And we also are able to give family planning products, such as an injectable contraception, as well as treatment for any STI that's detected on the STI test. So, a little bit more on the PrEP choice counseling process. As mentioned, it's structured, it's 5 steps. We use a lot of materials, including a quiz and a readiness assessment form. And important to know that this is something that the participants really just appreciate, and it gives them that confidence that they know everything about their PrEP choice, and they know that it's relevant and contextualized to their own lives. So when we look then at how people have accessed these two sites and how they've moved between the community and the mobile clinic, in our mobile, we definitely see the majority of our participants in this study, over 70% are mobile clients. And the mobiles tend to have a much faster rate of recruitment in terms of PrEP initiations, seeing about 160 to 190 new initiations per month, compared to a much smaller community at the clinic, which at its peak only sees about 100 new initiations per month. In terms of the people we're reaching, our mobiles definitely see a more diverse clientele. They see a lot of our young people, a lot of our heterosexual male partners, which have shown huge interest in injectable PrEP, as well as our gender and sexually diverse populations. However, there are populations who like the clinic, and the one that really stands out is the pregnant and breastfeeding woman. The majority of our PrEP initiations for that population have taken place at the clinic, largely coming from the antenatal care programs that happen there, but also potentially reflecting a preference for where that population is accessing PrEP. Interestingly, in terms of PrEP products, we see a much greater diversity of choice on our mobile. So people in all settings are more likely to choose the injectable, but there are a greater proportion of people also go for oral PrEP on the mobile. So it's more even distribution across all the choices. And we have all of our DAPI ring initiations have happened on the mobiles. Whereas at the clinic, there's been a really strong bias towards choosing the injectable, and no ring initiations happened at this at our in our clinic. That being despite the fact that both counselors at the clinic and the mobile are part of the same team, they have the same training, they have the same resources. So yeah, it was interesting to see that quite a difference. Not relevant to our injectable users yet, but something that we do for our oral and ring users who are initiated on PrEP, which means that they've had their baseline visit with the nurse, they've started on PrEP, and they've had that for all those baseline screenings done. But for people who really don't want to come back and they don't want to have a lot of engagement with the healthcare system, we offer them two additional options in terms of getting their PrEP. So that's courier delivery or a direct pickup. In order to be eligible for these, the participant just needs to express that they have interest in these services. So they might say, okay, I want courier delivery next time. And then the study team will contact them and say to them, would you still like that? And if they confirm, a courier with their PrEP product will be sent to their home. They'll be able to use the PrEP product sent at that time, but they will also be sent an HIV self-testing kit, which is they don't need to do on the spot, but they will need to do at some point if they want to continue getting the courier delivery, because then they need to do the test, take a picture, and send it to a dedicated WhatsApp line that confirms their HIV negative status. And then if they are negative, they are able to continue receiving PrEP in that way. The direct pickup is very similar in terms of a process, but the only difference is that you can come in, you don't have to have it delivered to your home. You can come into a community-based pharmacy, which is linked to our study pharmacy. And the only real difference here is that instead of just getting the HIV self-test to take home, they can do the test there with an HIV counselor who's positioned at that pharmacy. So they don't escape completely. We do see them still every 6 months, where they come in and we just check, the nurse sees them and checks that everything is still fine. But this is a very popular option for a lot of our oral and ring users. And one of the reasons why we think people might choose oral and ring over an injectable where they have to come in to see the nurse every 2 months. For our big overall lessons so far, these are all ongoing projects, but something that really stands out is that people need a choice of delivery site. There is really no delivery site that suits everyone perfectly. People like having options, and some sites are just better for some participants. We have seen that having access to more delivery points has led to greater persistence on PrEP, specifically on oral PrEP, which is something that historically people have really struggled to stay on. But we've seen that people who are able to access more distribution outlets, they have increased persistence, especially among young people. And of course, we know already the choice of product really matters. Our participants love the fact that they have a choice of three modalities. The injectable is incredibly popular in our setting. Majority of the people by far and across all populations do go for this option. And overall, we're finding that uptake and persistence is greater on the injectable than compared to our oral and ring users. So our big take home at the moment from these ongoing projects is that we remain very committed to differentiated service delivery for all of our PrEP options, including injectable. There's so much innovation that can happen across all of these spheres, and we hope to keep innovating and keep making sure that we're creating things that can be scaled up and that are sustainable. So I'd like to acknowledge our full team. Linda Gill is the PI for Prepared to Choose and for Fast PrEP. And we work in huge, highly skilled, wonderful teams. If you have any questions about any of our projects, you're welcome to contact me. My email is on the slide, or contact anyone at the organization through our social media. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. And we will transition it to Kevin Alosis from Houston, Texas, at Legacy Health, a large federally qualified health center in the nation. Take it away, Kevin.
Give me one second. Let me share my screen. Let's see. Can you all see my screen?
We cannot.
Okay, let me see.
We can now, Kevin.
Okay, awesome.
Beautiful.
Okay, awesome. I know we're almost at time, but I assure you my presentation is pretty short. So the first one I want to go. My name is Kevin Aloysius. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Operations here at Legacy Community Health. I wanted to give a little bit of a background on what how Legacy started. So in 1978, we started as the Montrose Clinic, which was founded to provide screening, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of sexually transmitted infections, primarily in gay men. So we have that long history. Currently, if you look at our clinic numbers, we have over 57 locations, over 1,500 employees, over 600,000 appointments completed, and over 215,000 members served. The reason I show the number is primarily via primary care clinic. The number of people we serve on PrEP is about 3,800, and the number of people living with HIV that we serve is about 8,000. In Harris County, where we're primarily located, one in three people that are living with HIV is serviced by Legacy. And the most recent data we have for Harris County shows about 1,200 people newly diagnosed with HIV. Also, I just want to show a little bit of our race and ethnicity. We have about 64% of our clients that are primarily Hispanic, about 19% are Black. And so these are some of the folks and the people we serve in Houston. What did we do? So in 2021, we trained a pharmacist to administer cabotegravir rilpivirine injections. Then in 2022, we trained them to administer cabotegravir injections. And then right now, we're training them to administer lenacapavir for PrEP. Why? So why did we include a pharmacist to do these injections? So first one is there was a lot of patient interest, but we had limited provider availability for appointments. During the time of COVID, we also had nursing and medical assistant staffing shortages. We were primarily located close to the largest medical center in the world, and so a lot of our staff ended up going there or ended up working for them. Our pharmacists were already conducting oral PrEP visits since 2018 under collaborative practice agreements with our providers. That means under the provider, they were able to order labs, they were able to approve refills, and they were able to do limited patient assessments. A pharmacy was already involved in logistics, so procurement, ordering, delivery, so it was a natural segue to have them also administer the injection. When we first started long-acting injections, we had a lot of questions, and our pharmacists were already trained as medication experts and were already doing a lot of the medication counseling. Then, during COVID, we had already built an extra vaccination rooms, and we also had vaccination appointment slots. So we were able to shift from using those for COVID vaccines to now using those empty slots for long-acting injections. One of the other things that helped us, the pharmacy hours were longer. So we were open on weekends and we were open longer during the weekday for the clinics. This really gave our clients an option to come after work or come on, it didn't interrupt their work schedule. And the other thing is, our clients were already used to getting vaccines in the pharmacy. So this is just a natural next step to get their long-acting injectables as well. So how do we do this? So currently, Texas law allows pharmacists to administer medications either via collaborative practice agreement or physician delegation. However, we were one of the first sites in Texas to do where the pharmacists are administering injections because typically most pharmacists use this authority to administer vaccines, B12 shots, or long-acting antipsychotic injections. Currently, we have one full-time pharmacist doing HIV treatment and prevention injections. During the visit, the pharmacist would conduct a PrEP-focused visit, do a point-of-care HIV test, order labs, and administer the injection. Part of this visit also ensured that the client just came in for one visit. Historically, we had clients come in a week before for the labs, then a week after for the appointment. For this one, for clients that are on long-acting injectables, but for PrEP, they just come in for one visit for both the administration of the injection as well as for the labs. So what happened in 2022? Less than 1% of our clients on PrEP were on long-acting injectable. In 2025, 10% of our clients are on long-acting injectables. Initially, we had over 500 injections administered. Right now, it's close to 2,200 injections. We had over 90% on-time injection rate, and then we had high patient satisfaction because we had reduced wait times and more flexible access points. One of the things we did was that we still have lots of availability where patients are able to walk in if they miss their appointments during the week. We also improve provider capacity to focus on more complex care needs. I just want to share a little bit of our clients that are on long-acting injectable PrEP. So I can see the majority of our clients are between the 30 to 39 and 40 to 49 age group, as well as the racial and ethnic diversity of our clients. So majority of our clients are actually white Hispanics, and then we have Black Americans that are the next largest cohort. Some of the feedbacks from the providers have been overwhelmingly positive because once prescribed, the pharmacy team completely takes over. We take over doing the prior authorization, procurement, whether it's through their pharmacy or medical benefits. We do the scheduling, we do the administration, we do the counseling. From the clients, it's easier buy-in. Some of the requests we've had for the clients was to have the same injector because we would rotate around a pharmacist. So now clients can request to have be on a specific pharmacist schedule. And then recently, we've been getting clients asking for us to initiate DoxyPEP. So working on the protocol with our providers to build that up. One of the reasons why we started this is in America, we say that every person lives within 5 miles off a pharmacy. And so we hope that this encourages more pharmacies and pharmacists to implement long-acting injections. So a couple of things, if someone is considering having pharmacists do these injections, to look at the legal and compliance, whether your local regulations allow that. Make sure you have an in-house training or certification program so that way you can provide comprehensive injection training. Understand the billing strategy. Pharmacists can sometimes be expensive professionals to do this. So, do we have any reimbursement strategies to cover the pharmacist administration cost? And then, cultural shift. Pharmacists typically are not involved in long-acting injections. So, make sure you get buy-in from providers, pharmacists, and patients to do that. Our pharmacists truly, we're happy to do this and really understood that endemic HIV epidemic in the South involves all of us, whether we are providers, pharmacists, or patients. And so just a little bit of takeaway is make sure task shifting to pharmacists is not just feasible, it's scalable. It improves access, equity, and operational efficiency. Pharmacists are underutilized champions of HIV prevention innovation. I might be biased, I'm a pharmacist, so that's probably why I said that. And so what's next for us to is to incorporate lenacapavir for PrEP in our workflows and ultimately advocating for policy changes to reimburse pharmacists administer PrEP injections directly. Yes, and so that concludes my presentation.
Kevin, thank you for that very short, sweet, and very practical presentation, which is what we need day to day in the clinic and with all those workflows. I'm going to open it up to questions. And while I see some people typing, or if there's anyone in the audience that would like to come off mute, and we welcome to see everyone's smiling faces. If anyone has a question, while I am waiting for someone to come off mute, Jim Pickett, just because of how the screen is laid out, let me know if someone has raised their hand. Kevin, I'll direct the first question to you. Now you're at some point you had to ask your pharmacist to inject. I'm sure that caused like a cringe in some people's stomachs or grimaces on their faces. How did you have that dialogue, and what were, one or two key takeaways to bring pharmacists to be more comfortable or to address their concerns?
So we had lots of trainings, both internally by nurses who typically were the ones that were administering it. So they came and trained us. But what was really insightful was we had actually a panel of people living with HIV come and talk to our pharmacists, letting them know how important this is and stories about how if they had access to prevention, it could have prevented them getting HIV. I was one of those panelists. So having involvement and getting patient testimonials was one of the ways to get buy-ins. The other thing was it was during COVID. We had already trained our pharmacists to do COVID vaccines, which we hadn't done before. And then we had to train a pharmacist to do mpox vaccines, which I haven't done before. So they were kind of used to kind of doing this. And so I think, but really it's just the education, the patient testimonials, and the fact that, that things were changing around the world during that time. So we were asking them already to do innovative things. So I was glad that they were on board.
Thank you for that answer. I'm going to go. I asked Yanni to type this out, but I wanted to also kind of have her verbalize it. Yanni had an exceptional time where she was presenting something totally different to a country that technically doesn't do a lot of task shifting, especially in the realm of antiretroviral, something considered conservative in care, and is looked upon as really should be in the hands of a highly trained physicians, kind of back what we saw in the mantra of the 1990s. Yanni, what were some selling points to even get the Ministry of Health having a dialogue with you, and to give you the space for a pilot?
Oh, thank you for the question, Rupa. So when I realized that whenever we present something new, there were always a lot of people were not open to new ideas. So we would try how we the first thing that we framed it was that PrEP is for HIV prevention, and it is one of the ways, the critical ways to end the HIV epidemic. So we need to provide more access point, not only just the we already have the free PrEP in public health clinics, but looking at the numbers, not everyone wants to go to the public health clinic. So, and we already have access in private clinics, so there got to be more access points. So, why not the pharmacies? So the pharmacies are already trained in providing sexual health counseling, in providing oral contraceptives. So we're just building on that, and they're already widely accessible. So when I engage with the Ministry of Health, so we have more than 3,000 pharmacies in Malaysia. I see that as a really great opportunity to expand PrEP access. And first of all, one of the barriers to PrEP use in Malaysia is that there is generally a low awareness and understanding about PrEP. So first of all, we have to get the PrEP information out there. So why not leverage pharmacies to provide information about PrEP so that, it's in a way also to create demand for PrEP. When people know more about PrEP, then only they start thinking like, maybe PrEP is for me. How do I find out about that? So I was telling the Ministry of Health, like in Malaysia, people can go in and out of pharmacies. We don't pay for consultation. It's all free advice. And people often go to pharmacies. They don't have to register. And there's this anonymity factor there. People like to go for pharmacies for free advice. So why not leverage pharmacies for that? So, and also that people can also have at the moment, public health clinics, we have really a large number of, it's often overcrowded. So I think eventually we would need to collaborate with private pharmacies and clinics to provide more access to PrEP.
Excellent, thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Carrie. Carrie, you have a huge, wonderful program and it's expanding and expanding. Do you think you'll have to try different versions of task shifting and scope of work to continue the expansion? And what could that be? Like, where could a HIV prevention counselor do more, or a certain nurse of a shorter training take on more tasks?
Thanks, Rupa. Yeah, we're definitely always trying to push the envelope in this space, and we do love adding new innovations to our really big program. We're currently planning to incorporate the lenacapavir injection fairly soon onto the program as well, which will obviously be a subcut, so something different for our providers to get used to. If the pharmacy legislation goes through, that's definitely an area we will look into and be quite excited about. A lot of the pharmacists we work with are quite excited about seeing that come through. In terms of the HIV counselor versus different types of nurses, there is a push at the moment for different levels of nurses to be able to give out PrEP. Currently, it's only a professional nurse or a clinical nurse practitioner, but there are other levels of nursing staff that could be involved. So yeah, it's definitely a space we're working in. Thank you.
As we're waiting for questions and people to not be shy and come off their unblock their camera and come off mute. Juan Carlos, this question is directed to you. Now you've pushed the envelope quite a bit. You have a very unique cadre of workers handling injections of antiretrovirals. And I understand they're doing cabotegravir and they're bracing themselves for lenacapavir. Now that you've opened, expanded the envelope in the clinical setting and all your lessons learned, what do you think you can do more with your program? What do you envision over the next 5 years?
Yes, thank you, Ruba. That's a great question. So what NETS is to include that the injectable delivery of injectable on our mobile clinic, right? So this is an envision that Megan and I have been talking about, and that's what how we want to continue to expand our reach, right? Going out, meeting people where they are, how to get to places with our mobile clinic. We have a brand new mobile clinic. It has been a little bit of a challenge because of the billing process, but we are ready and to roll like by the end of the year, delivering that care where and meeting people where they are. So very excited about that.
Wonderful. And Megan, do you, we have 1 or 2 minutes. I had questions for each of the speakers. Megan, you've done something revolutionary where you're like going into the home with antiretrovirals and injecting. Do you see you being able to move beyond 50, or is this kind of home program really made for a certain type of individual and you've like capped on the community that would really just want that kind of care and that entourage of people coming into their home, being seen in their lobby, in their stairway? Can you comment on the scope of home injections? Where does it end for us?
Sure. I think that is the big question, right? Is this sustainable and scalable? And I think the strength that we have right now is really identifying who can benefit from this. And the MORE program also is very dynamic in that we ask the patients exactly what they need. And their needs are going to change over time. And so I think we have to actively ask these questions as time goes on. Like, do you still need us to come to your home? Or do you feel more comfortable coming in now? What if the mobile care navigator gets you an Uber and you come in and they meet you there and they kind of help you through the clinic? So really trying to make it like a living process, right? Not like you get home injections forever, but like maybe we just get you back on the feet and your feet until you're feeling better or for until you're more comfortable with the clinic environment, and then you start to come back in. If we were to scale in its current form, we'll obviously need another provider and maybe another care navigator. I mean, we could add those positions, but I do think the beauty of it is, and why it's not like financially crippling for us is that we keep it small and we really reserve it for those who truly need it.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank all the speakers and the audience, the engaging audience, for the multiple questions. Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. So let's give some love to our wonderful innovators and task shifters. As I said in the chat, I think with all the things that we're facing in terms of cuts and terminations, terrible policies coming out of the regime in Washington that are impacting all of us in various ways, these are things we can do that are actually inspiring and helpful and can really make the difference in our PrEP programs, injectable, long-acting, and otherwise. So really much love and thank you to Kevin and Nani and Carrie and Juan Carlos and Megan for sharing all their brilliance and genius and creativity. And to my partner in crime on this, Rupa, who really masterminded it all and is a mastermind behind a lot of task shifting and innovation that's happening in the PrEP space. So big kudos to you, Rupa. Thank you all for being here. Everyone who registered, over 200 people, will be getting an email in the next day or so when our materials are online, the slides, the recording, and a resource document will be attached. All of that will be online for your for your pleasure and your task shifting pleasure. We'll also be sharing this, I think, widely because I would like this to have a lot of legs. This is really important work, and I would love to have some more webinars that focus on this. I think this has been really super practical and super helpful and doable for all of us to think about. So thanks again to all of you. Thanks to everyone who joined us. Thanks to everyone who will be consuming this in their own time at a different time in a different place. And with that said, take good care. Hang in there. If you're in the United States, resist, resist, resist. And it's Pride weekend here in Chicago. I know it's Pride in many other major cities this weekend. So happy Pride to you all. And also a reminder that every day is Pride 365/7. So with that, we'll say goodbye and have a good one.